and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the battle lines being drawn between the Obama White House and AIPAC, the powerful pro-Israel lobby, whose leaders refused an Oval Office offer by the president to be officials who negotiated the P5+1 deal with Iran in order to correct the disinformation and distortions that AIPAC, Prime Minister Netanyahu, and Republican lawmakers are spreading in a concerted propaganda campaign to kill the deal. A former Capitol Hill staffer and editor of AIPAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy, M.J. Rosenberg, a special correspondent to The Washington Spectator and The Huffington Post, joins us. We'll discuss influential Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer's break with the White House and whether that and AIPAC's forthcoming junket for Democratic lawmakers to Israel to meet with Netanyahu will peel off enough Democrats to override a presidential veto of an expected Republican House and Senate rejection of the deal. Then we will speak with Chris Parker, a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington and author of Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. We will discuss the first Republican presidential debate on Fox News that was orchestrated by Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch to discredit the Tea Party favorite frontrunner Donald Trump, who since the debate has done a very effective job of discrediting himself. Since the Republican Party is in total denial about what an embarrassment they have become, we will look into whether the few sane voices on the crowded stage will survive the primary process. Then finally, on the one-year anniversary of the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, we will speak with Garrett Duncan, a professor of education and of African and African-American studies at the University of Washington in St. Louis. We will discuss what improvements have been made in the community since the killing of Michael Brown and what remains to be done. And joining us now is M.J. Rosenberg, who is a special correspondent to The Washington Spectator and a columnist for The Huffington Post. He worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years, and previously M.J. Rosenberg served as director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and was an editor of Near East Report, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee's APAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, M.J. Rosenberg. What's happening? We don't have M.J.? Oh, okay. Hopefully he will show up soon here. We are hoping to, unfortunately, this is live radio, so we'll have him on in a second, I believe. And we will again be speaking with M.J. Rosenberg. M.J., are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. So the meeting that took place recently in the Oval Office with President Obama and the top people in the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, my understanding from New York Times reports is that at that meeting in the Oval Office, President Obama offered to have Wendy Sherman and the other top officials who made the P5+1 deal with Iran brief them to explain exactly what is in the deal and to counter the kind of disinformation and distortions that have been are out there, and that the AIPAC officials refused to meet with the people who negotiated the P5+1. And that led Obama a couple of days later in his speech at the American University in defense of his P5+1 deal with Iran, suggesting that there are these kind of forces out that are torpedoing or attempting to torpedo the deal are actually, in effect, on the same page as the death to America hardliners in Iran. So is that your understanding of what happened?
Yes, that I know that for a fact. That is, that is what happened. And it's the president was taken aback by it because, I mean, he's gone out of his way to meet with the AIPAC people, even though they're lobbying against his biggest foreign policy initiative. And then he treated them as if their differences were those that could be resolved by the facts. And therefore, I'll just bring in my negotiators. He said that they could stay as long as the AIPAC people needed to explain everything to them and for them to ask any question they want, and they said no. They are only. It was interesting. It's almost these, and these are AIPAC's own people. I mean, and they don't want them to be exposed to anything that's not completely mediated, if not dictated, by AIPAC. It's one again one of these incredibly disrespectful, you know, treatments of the United States, of the President of the United States.
So, AIPAC, of course, managed to peel off Chuck Schumer, an influential Democratic senator who's now opposing his own president's and party leader's singular foreign policy achievement. What's your understanding of his reasoning? Because he's been briefed, and yet he still says that there's something wrong. But with that, what is he saying that is wrong with this deal? I have not been able to figure it out.
I mean, I read his statement, and most of it is pretty easy to read. But he's saying the same thing that all the, all the critics are saying, is that, you know, Iran could easily break out and, break out and therefore start developing a bomb. And before we got around to doing anything about it, they'd have a bomb. A whole bunch of things that the administration, in particular, Moniz, what's the Secretary of the Energy guy's name? The nuclear physicist.
Ernie Moniz, yeah.
Moniz, yeah. Who, he's just so good at rebutting that and explaining that. But I don't think it really those things don't matter to Schumer. Schumer, he has been deluged by the Orthodox and Zionist communities in New York who are, you know, threatening him, and which of course is ridiculous. They couldn't really do anything to him, but they're telling him, you know, we depend on you and blah, blah, blah. And he just didn't want to stand up to them. I don't think that the merits have anything to do with what Schumer decided. To me, the evidence of that is he never mentioned Israel in his statement. It's sort of like, really? I mean, that's the big issue. Anyone who reads the news knows that's the big issue for Schumer and those like him. And he doesn't mention it because it's just that's what I sort of perversely, that's what it's all about. He said, and in one of my pieces online, I found the quote where he said that he views his role in the Senate as Israel's guardian. That's how he views it. He says that his name, Schumer, is a variant of the Hebrew word shomer, which means guardian, and that he views himself as Israel's guardian of the Senate. I mean, that's all you need to know. I don't think he's motivated really by love of Israel or by Judaism. He's not religious. He's never much been involved with Israel other than as a member of Congress. You know, what he really is the guardian of money to the Democrats. You know, he was the head of the Senate Democratic Campaign Committee. He is the Democratic Party in the Senate's number one man in terms of raising money, and that means raising a lot of money from the AIPAC wing of the Democratic Party, and he doesn't want to jeopardize that by supporting this Obama initiative that is an anathema to those big Democratic donors, like, for instance, Chaim Saban, who is Hillary's biggest donor. These are, you know, really important. If you notice, Hillary made one statement in support of the agreement, and then she's gone totally dark on it. I mean, these people are afraid. It's all about the money. And when people say, oh, it's all about, oh, they're really more loyal to Israel than the United States, or blah, 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 it's not that. Is they're more loyal to money than to anything else. They want, that's what our system is about, campaign cash. And 40% of all the money that the Democratic Party raises comes from American Jews. Now, politicians incorrectly think that the reason that they get that money is because of Israel. It's not. The reason they get most of that money is because they're the liberals, and Democrats are liberals. But the most vocal donors talk about Israel, and that is that's the big factor in this whole game, the campaign money, not Judaism, not really Israel itself, but the money associated with Israel.
So it's a little depressing to think that reason and rationality can't prevail even in the Democratic Party, because we know the Republicans have absolutely no time for facts and reason. They are entirely faith-based in terms of all of their policies, it would seem, but judging from that recent Republican presidential debate, it's pretty depressing to think that the Democrats are going in that same direction, because...
They're not going in that same direction. The Republicans are being true to who they are. In pretty much in every international situation, Republicans are the hawks, they're the interventionists, they're the anti-diplomacy people. Their position on this is absolutely consistent with the rest of their foreign policy positions. The real hypocrites are the Democrats. The Democrats are the party that believe in diplomacy. It's the Democratic president who got this deal. It's the Democratic Democrats who support things like, you know, normalization with Iran. It's Democrats who everyone who opposed the Iraq war, even though many supported it, everyone who opposed it were Democrats. It's the Democrats who are groveling for the money here. The Republicans are being just... it's just who the Republicans are. So I'm much more angry at these Democrats than I am at the Republicans. And I don't think faith really has anything to do with it. I just think it's who they are. They basically have never seen, you know, you listen to someone like Lindsey Graham. He doesn't need, it's not about faith. He's not a religious guy. He doesn't need money to win elections. For him, it's just a diplomacy. Whenever I see it, I hate it. I mean, that's what they're all about.
Well, I was just thinking, though, in terms of how Obama tried to tell these APEC officials what the deal's about, and they weren't interested in getting a briefing on what the deal really is. They just want to go out there and join with the Republicans and with Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu in this concerted propaganda campaign to kill the deal. And right. What Obama said in response at the American University was this line that upset a lot of people, which was that the Republicans are in effect on the same page as the Iranian hardliners.
That is actually
quite factual when you think about it. First of all, my understanding is that one of the reasons why the Iranian delegation at the last minute didn't make the deal on the deadline prescribed was because the Supreme Leader, who's clearly a hardliner, pulled the rug out from under them. But then he later reversed himself. But the effect of that was that would trigger, instead of a 30-day review by the House and Senate on the deal, it triggered a 60-day review. And that what the hardliners in Iran are counting on is that the U.S. Congress will scuttle Obama's deal, and then the U.S. is going to look like the spoiler and the odd man out, because the rest of the world will go ahead and make the deal with Iran and the sanctions, and America will be left out in the cold, and American businessmen who want to do deals with Iran will be left out in the cold, and the hardliners will be able to say, see, we were right about the Americans, because they're not happy with the deal in the first place. So that's my understanding of the dynamics here.
No, I agree. They are tacit allies in this, and you know it's not that unusual. It's very similar to what goes on the Israeli-Palestinian front, where it's the people who are opposed to the two-state solution because they want Israel to keep everything are the ones who are responsible for the growth of organizations like Hamas and for the failure of a relative moderate like Arafat to achieve the two-state deal with Rabin, that kind of thing. I suppose there are lots of parallels for this, where ironically the hardliners on one side strengthen the hardliners on the other side, but they don't care. I don't think the Republicans, they get offended at being told that they're basically on the same side as the Ayatollah's most hardline advisors and himself, but they're offended by it, but they don't really care. It doesn't, the thing about the Republican Party today is they don't wish the United States well. I mean, it's like, I think, you know, a friend of mine was mentioning that, most countries, European countries and, Canada and the rest have, two parties, and they have a right wing, a conservative party. But no one but the United States has as its main conservative opposition a party that wants the country to fail. that never joins with the, in this case, the majority to achieve something for the country. I mean, it's really it, and that in other countries, what is the Republican Party here is the equivalent of the Le Pen Party in France. You know, it's like it's, you know, it's a strange situation. It's almost like we skipped over what in other countries would be a regular, normal opposition to a crazed right wing and pretty anti-American opposition. It's really, I can't think of a single success that Obama could have that the Republicans would applaud. And that's just remarkable. And I don't know how any Democratic president will ever be able to, to work around it. Though I have to say that when Obama takes them on, and in this case takes on the Republican opposition, takes on the AIPAC opposition, takes on, all of them, he's making it easier for whoever the next president is to stand up to these people. Because it's really an outrageous situation. I have to say it's more outrageous when it involves a foreign country's interest than when it just involves, let's say, the oil industry's interest or the gun lobby's interest. Because here you have them all lining up for the interests of Israel, a foreign country, over the interests of their own country, the United States. That's pretty remarkable.
Right. Well, of course, President Ronald Reagan did stand up to AIPAC over the sale of AWACS reconnaissance planes to Saudi Arabia in 1981. And George H.W. Bush did take on AIPAC in a fight over housing loan guarantees for Israel. But what I find extraordinary here is that Schumer is betraying not only his own president but his own party, but he's also betraying the Constitution of the United States, because whatever party and whatever president follows, this is a precedent that is really dangerous and cripples American diplomacy, because any American president who makes a deal is now subject to the whims of Congress overturning it. And so nobody in the world will want to make a deal with the U.S. or at least believe in a deal that they've made. So just to get to the heart of it, though, in the last couple of minutes, MJ Rosenberg, since the objections to this deal coming from Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel and the Republicans and AIPAC don't make any sense, certainly on security grounds, the truth of the matter is that Israel can wipe Iran off the map, not the other way around, and that this deal actually is good for Israel, as the top intelligence people in Israel are now telling Netanyahu. But that obviously doesn't carry any water with these people. What I seem to think, and a number of people I've spoken to in Washington think, that what's really going on here is it's not about the nuclear deal with Iran. It's about Israel and the right wing in Israel, I should say, the Netanyahu types, basically don't want the U.S. to have any flexibility in its Middle East policy. They don't want America to be able to talk to who they want to talk to. They want to be able to decide who America talks to and who America deals with. And that's what they're upset about, that the U.S. might have a choice of dealing with the Iranians later on when they moderate and become more reasonable.
It's about a large part of what it's about. I don't believe that any Israeli official really believes they're threatened by Iran in terms of Iran's theoretical nuclear weapons. I think it's this idea of the United States having a foreign policy independent of Israel. If Israel opposes the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, we have proposed the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. If Israel prefers a military guy like Sisi, if they support him, we support him. They don't want us, the United States, to have any friends in the Muslim world without their permission. They can decide. If they decide, look, if they made a peace deal with far-fetched Assad Syria tomorrow, then we could do the same thing. I mean, they want to be in charge of our foreign policy, not just in the Arab world, but with the entire Muslim world. And here, we're kind of like breaking out of that straitjacket. If we're opening up to Iran, they think God knows where this is going to lead. The United States might go totally rogue and have its own Middle East foreign policy. And that is what both Netanyahu and his lobby, AIPAC, won't permit.
Well, do you think, though, that given that the lines are drawn now and it's pretty clear what this battle's really about, that the American people will start questioning people with who are more loyal to Israel than they are to the United States, or appear to be more loyal to Israel than they are to the United States?
No, I don't think that's not the way it works in this country. I don't think that will happen. I don't think we have that kind of a political tradition. I do, however, I think that Obama is going to prevail. So therefore, deals will be approved and good things will happen ultimately. There'll be struggles, but it basically will all be good or better than the alternative. I think the way that could happen is if they succeed in killing the deal and then really bad things happen. Bad things happen to Israel. Maybe Iran does go ahead and develop a nuclear weapon because they would not have to have any inspections or anything. Or any number of bad things could happen that would happen as a result of AIPAC having killed the deal. Perversely, or that their success in killing the deal could bring about that contingency that you describe, where people start wondering, well, which side are they on anyway? Who are they more loyal to? I don't think it's going to happen because Obama's going to prevail, and we're not going to see any number of bad things happen that would happen if AIPAC wins this fight.
Well, MJ Rosenberg, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with MJ Rosenberg, who's a special correspondent to the Washington Spectator and a columnist for the Huffington Post. He worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years and previously served as the director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and was an editor of Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the recent Republican presidential primary debate that was the culmination of the Tea Party takeover of the Republican Party.
Oh yeah, yeah, oh yeah, yeah. War is not the answer.
Mr. War not the answer.
Politician and them bobo nyasin. War is not the answer. I think you know what the solution Rasta says. Yeah. War is not the answer. Tell the politician and them start drop them bomb. Yeah. War is not the answer. I think you know what the solution Rasta says. Yeah.
You've been born with what skin? They explain. And the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train. But it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in our game.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Chris Parker, a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He is the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics and the director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington and author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book is Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Parker.
Hey, it's nice to be back, Ian. You know I really must like you if I'm receiving your calls on a Sunday morning.
Well, I'm sure grateful that you answer the call because your book basically makes it clear about the Tea Party takeover of the Republican Party. But if anybody doubted that, all they had to do was watch the presidential debate on Fox News on Thursday night to see that this was an entire reductio absurdum of the Tea Party takeover of the Republican Party, because the job, you could see from the outset that this was entirely orchestrated by Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch, and their orders to their flunkies, the reporters from Fox News, was to discredit the Tea Party favorite frontrunner Donald Trump. Which is very paradoxical, since Fox News has built up the Tea Party and now it's gotten out of hand, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was just a clown car. I mean, it was a clown car, train wreck, whatever metaphor one wants to use, that's what it was the other night. And he prevailed. I mean, Donald Trump is basically, he's getting away with this. And I would argue the principal reason for his success is because he's got, he's receiving most of his support. Now, this is ultimately an empirical question, But I think he's getting most of his support from these Tea Partiers. These folks vote in the primaries. They're very knowledgeable about political process, you know, and they will have their voices heard. You know, we said so in the 2014 book, and it's coming true right now. It's manifest right now as we speak.
Well, I thought the most effective moment in the speech, and it actually was a moment of profound truth, was when Donald Trump, when he was asked about giving money to Hillary Clinton, he said, you know, I give money to everybody. I give money to all you guys on the stage. You know, you've all asked for money, and I've given it to you willingly. And that's how politics work. You know, you get money. You give money to these politicians, and when you need them, you call them up, and they do exactly what you want. And he is describing America's totally money-driven, corrupt politics. And it was so clear, and I know that that's, you know, and I'm saying this in praise of the Tea Party, I know that their rank and file feel that way. They're not stupid.
Oh no, they're very far from stupid. They're very, very far from stupid, and they appreciate that. But let me tell you what perhaps resonates with them more. You know, are his basically unedited, unfiltered views of immigrants. That really resonates with them a lot more. I mean, you know, ultimately, I think that's why they're following him. Of course, you know, they're pissed off about the money in politics. But what he's saying about illegal immigrants, as we show in the book and as I've shown in any number of pieces, including pieces for the Brookings Institution, that, you know, when it comes to illegal immigration, think about the Senate bill. Senate bill, I believe it was 70, or I think it was 70, that had all of these conservative measures in it. I mean, it had shoring up the borders, you know, it showed all of the economic advantages or promise, you know, that would occur if there was a path to citizenship. I mean, and the Senate conservatives signed off on it, but it was the people in the House, the Tea Party contingent in the House, that refused to let that legislation pass. So I think for the most part, I'm not saying the Tea Parties are single issue, but this is probably the most important issue on their agenda right now.
But did you notice, though, Chris, the Rupert Murdoch's fingerprints on this and Roger Ailes, the idea that their real job was to discredit and try to stop the surge in popularity of Donald Trump? And they started out right out of the gate by asking the loyalty question about would you run as a third-party candidate? And, since then, of course, Donald Trump's done a pretty good job of discrediting himself.
No, he's done an excellent job of discrediting himself. More, you know, especially with the whole Megyn Kelly remark. I mean, let me say a couple things. The first of which is the misogynist tone of his remarks toward Megyn Kelly. But this follows a larger pattern throughout the years of these misogynist remarks that he's made. But so here's the point. He's still not falling in the polls. I mean, we still have yet to see a poll since at least I haven't seen anything recently or in the last couple of days about where he is since his tweet on Megyn Kelly, and furthermore, you know, his remarks towards her on stage. But I would imagine, at least among Tea Partiers, he's not going to fall that far. And let me tell you why he's not going to fall that far is because the women that support the Tea Party are the same kind of women that are these Phyllis Schlafly conservatives who believes a woman's place is in the home and yada 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 and all that stuff. So that's sort of one comment that I want to make. When he says he does well among women, I'm sure he's not doing well across the board, but among conservative women, you know, with the exception of, you know, some of the, you know, like some of the conservative women right now that are heading these, some of these large conservative think tanks, he's doing pretty well. I would imagine. I would not be surprised at that. And sort of the second thing I wanted to bring up is you know, this idea that, you know, these Republicans are, I mean, just look at how they set him up. I mean, you're completely right about this, Ian. Roger Ailes and Fox, they set him up to fail, but he's still doing well. I mean, think about his attacks against, you know, John McCain, you know, this conservative icon, and questioning his war record. He's still maintaining his lead, you know, throughout. And the point I'm trying to make is that these Tea Party folks, they vote. They pay attention. As a matter of fact, what's so crazy about this is in our survey, 60% of all Tea Partiers get all of their news and information from Fox News. 60%. And so I am really not surprised, you know, that he continues to be where he is in the polls. Now, of course, you know, we need to see what's going to happen in the next few days, you know, after his continuous tweets and continuing to put his foot in his mouth with Megyn Kelly. But I'm telling you, I would not be surprised if he does not go down too far.
Well, it certainly strikes me as an irony that suddenly the Republican Party and Fox News are the champions of women's rights. That's a new one. And also the fact that, you know, Murdoch and Ailes are the ones who built up the Tea Party in the first place. And to my mind, you know, they're reaping what they sow, and the Republican Party is. But what was interesting about it was, and I've heard this from some reasonable Republicans since, saying that if Kasich, the governor of Ohio, who by far was the most reasonable person on the stage, and I'm not saying that because I'm a liberal or a progressive, I'm saying that because I think he was just simply, objectively, much more rational and reasonable. And he wasn't saying what I wanted him to hear. He was saying what I think the Republicans need to hear and that they used to hear. And I've heard speculation that Republicans would like to have Kasich on the ticket with Marco Rubio. And if you think about it, they'd probably win with that ticket. But they won't. They won't. They'll elect some nutcase, I'm sure.
Well, they're not going to win with that ticket because the Tea Partiers are not going to get behind those guys. They're simply not going to get behind them. Oh, another thing I wanted to mention before I ramble for a second, I will admit I did as much, is that, you know, Trump basically presented his competition with a pinata. He basically said, please hit me with some of those remarks he made and some of those, he had no policy. He had no coherent statement when it came to policy on anything. Just going out, you know, with these ad hominem attacks on, you know, the political elite, they're stupid. I mean, come on. No one called him on this stuff. I mean, you know, when he attacked Megyn Kelly, no one called him on this. And you know why? The reason why no one called him on this is because his competition or the other candidates on the stage are scared of running afoul of these reactionary voters who are supporting Donald Trump. They really want no parts of them.
Well, I think that's why probably at the end of the day, and that's why the guy from Texas, Ted Cruz, has never repudiated anything that Trump has said. He's going to pick up his people. If they destroy Trump or he destroys himself or a combination of both, the winner will be, of course, Ted Cruz in terms of that constituency. So, Chris, I want to ask you about what just happened up in Seattle where you are. Bernie Sanders had there's a big rally for him in Seattle. And he was about to speak at this rally when some activists from Black Lives Matter just grabbed the microphone and started to scream at the audience and actually accuse all of the white progressives in the audience of being white supremacist liberals. Bernie Sanders didn't even get to speak. So what's going on there? Because it seems pretty strange to me that as a tactic, why would you want to go after the only people in the white community that really care about minority issues, as opposed to go after those, reactionary right-wing politicians in the South, in the House and the Senate, and in the legislatures in the South who are suppressing the vote and who are openly opposed to any rights for minorities.
Well, see, the problem here is this. I mean, so I was a little surprised by that as well. But when I really stopped and think about it in retrospect, I mean, I can give you a really nice anecdote. So in my class, one of my last classes in the winter quarter, we had this discussion, and you had some white students that tried to come out and say all lives matter, and the black students were like, no, black lives matter, because it's already implied that white lives matter. And so the whole idea, like when you think about the progressives, I mean, Hillary Clinton just came around to saying Black Lives Matter because for a while she was saying all lives matter. And that is, okay, so we emphasize that Black Lives Matter because clearly, historically, that has not been the case. And we have started to see that ever since, I would argue, since what, you know, the Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin incident, where Zimmerman actually got off on murdering Trayvon Martin. And, you know, we see what kind of screw up he is. He's back to his old tricks. I mean, this guy has been under arrest any number of times since then. But the point is that black lives do matter. And it's the point of the matter is what they were trying to say. These demonstrators are trying to say, hey, look, they're trying to yank these progressive candidates to the understanding that black lives do matter, and we need to emphasize that point. It's clear that other lives matter, that white lives matter. That's implied. But what they're trying to convey is like, look, you know, Seattle is supposedly this progressive city. But let me tell you, in the survey research we do every year, we do what's called a Washington poll, the Washington poll here in Seattle, of which I direct. And let me tell you, people want to say Seattle's a really progressive city, and relative to other places, that may be the case. But there are a fair number of racists here in Seattle as well. So those women who interrupted Bernie Sanders' speech and wouldn't let him talk and, in fact, grabbed the microphone, they were not without justification in calling out, you know, these supposedly putative, progressive whites in Seattle. They were not out of their depth in saying that. So I agree, maybe not with their tactics, but certainly with their message, that we need to continue to emphasize that black lives matter. We need to continue with this stress, with this message, because clearly it is not taking right now.
Right, but Bernie Sanders doesn't believe that all lives matter. I mean, he's never said that. Yes, and also those people in the audience are not white supremacists. They might be liberals, but they're not white supremacists. So it was a white supremacist who shot all those worshippers in the AME church in Charleston. There's a huge difference between being a white progressive in America and being a white supremacist.
No, believe me, as a black man, I realize that. Hold on. Brooklyn, stop it. As a black man in America, believe me, I realize that. We all know where those white supremacists come down. But we're trying to get the moderates and progressives, you know, to really rally to our cause even more. All right. The problem is that it's not that Bernie Sanders has not said that he hasn't gainsaid Black Lives Matter, but he hasn't come out in full throat of support of it either. So I think that is one of the points that they were trying to convey, that he was not out in front of this. Yes, he's supposedly this progressive candidate, you know, who's about the people, who's about the little person, but he has not come out in full-throated support of Black Lives Matter. And so what these people were trying to do, we're trying to bring more attention to this. We know where the white supremacists are. We know that they don't believe that Black Lives Matter, right? But what we're trying to do, or what the movement is trying to do, is trying to get more full-throated, more explicit support for the movement from progressives and from moderates. And if that happens, then maybe the movement will continue to gain momentum. But until that happens, it might continue to remain in stasis. Because right now, we don't have, I mean, outside of Hillary mentioning it one or two times, we don't really have any mainstream candidates talking about this. In fact, at the Republican debate, I mean, think about it. The only race question was asked to Ben Carson, and it wasn't clear he knew what was going on regarding anything. And they asked the only black person, the only race question. My buddy and I could not believe it. Well, we could believe it, but it was just shocking to us.
Right.
So, you know, despite the Black Lives Matter and race agenda, you know, on Twitter, you know, was really trending. I think it was in the top five. No, it was on Facebook. It was within the top five subjects on which, you know, Facebook's discussions were taking place, but they didn't really mention it in any systematic way outside of asking the token black person the token race question.
Well, we'll see what happens with Bernie Sanders. He'll be here in Los Angeles on Monday speaking at the Los Angeles Memorial Sports Arena, which is a huge venue. Doors open at 6 p.m. So we'll see whether the Black Lives Matter that they prevent him from speaking there again. The point being, the guy's got to be able to speak to at least say where he stands on these issues, don't you think? I mean, at least give him a break. Well, Chris, it's always good to talk to you. I thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Ian. Please call on me again at any time.
Even on a Sunday.
Even on a Sunday, brother.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And, And again, I've been speaking with Chris Parker, who's a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He's the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics and director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington. And he's the author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans, and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book is Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back and go to Ferguson, Missouri for an update on the one-year anniversary since the killing of Michael Brown. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Garrett Duncan, a professor of education and of African and African American studies in arts and sciences at the University of Washington in St. Louis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Garrett Duncan.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
And Garrett, we spoke a lot a year ago, today being the one-year anniversary of the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, that led to widespread protests that got both national and international attention. And here we are a year later, and what's your feeling there in the community? Has much changed?
Well, things have changed, but I'm concerned, as are others, because the community extends much farther and further out than Ferguson or St. Louis. It seems to be an escalation of the death of black children, black women, black men, and other folks as well. But at the same time, we know it's not an escalation. This has been happening prior to Emmett Till, or a lot later, LaTosha Harlins. So that causes grave concern among us. In St. Louis, there have been nearly 120 deaths this year, and it's barely August, and many of those are at the hands of other black youth. But at the same time, there have been substantive change. The community has taken it on itself to organize and to commemorate Michael Brown, and to create opportunities for folks who did not have them. And in addition, I must also say that I'm impressed partly with our governmental structure for the substantive changes it's made in the wake of the death of Michael Brown.
Well, my understanding is that the abusive municipal court practices, which led to a lot of the anger that the community felt because they were constantly being shaken down for jaywalking and other minor infractions in essentially what was a racket that the white-dominated council of Ferguson and other outlying suburbs of St. Louis used to essentially fund their police force and their municipal services. So the people were getting lousy service from their local government, at the same time being extorted with unnecessary traffic tickets that would often go to warrant and end up costing them a fortune.
I'm glad you provided that background, because many think that the death of Michael Brown sparked the outrage. That was the pinpoint that that led to it, but it was within a broader context that you just described. And that is why we say Black Lives Matter. Self-evident in that is that all lives matter. But when it's told back to us, it's told dismissively and not looking at the circumstances. Indeed, all lives should matter, but they don't. And what you just described, the practices with the traffic tickets, warrants, and all these other things are much greater related against our black communities and any other community. Trafficking, child trafficking, is largely the result of kidnapping black girls. And when their parents go to police departments typically tell them, your child has run away, and we don't deal with runaways. The guns in our communities, we do not bring the guns in our communities. As indicated by the documentary, the CIA's war or the FBI's war on black America, and also a documentary, The Fire This Time, guns are actually brought into our community often by law officials, whether we're talking about the CIA, and this is based on COINTELPRO information, or local police officers. And the main reason is not overt racism, but they could get away with this because the death of black people, especially by the hands of black people, is considered unremarkable. This these practices occur to provide the rationale to get greater weaponry for these different departments, which has resulted in the militarization of our police force. You saw the tanks, and you saw what would typically be used in a war. And so these things are going on as well.
Well, that is something, though, that President Obama did address when he signed an executive order creating the Task Force on 21st Century Policing, where he cut this Pentagon program that was recycling military equipment into police forces. So that would seem to be some progress, right?
That would be some progress, but my concern is that there have been deaths as a result of the practices of recycling guns into our community, and no one has been held account for it, these deaths and tragedies.
And in terms of what we were talking about earlier about how the abusive municipal court practices have been curbed, the Missouri legislature passed a bill capping the amount of revenues from the municipalities can collect from tickets, and Governor Jay Nixon signed that last month. That's clearly at least something that's a major. I'm trying to look for some silver linings here.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And that's why I refer to it as a tug of war. So we acknowledge these things, but we here on the ground know that there is much more to be done, because in light of what you just said, against that, and this is a gray lining, the reduction of the teaching force here in the St. Louis area, and for a lack of funds. And we have funds, is how decisions are made. But what you said is, I acknowledge that as being absolutely positive.
And again, I'm speaking with Garrett Duncan, a professor of education and of African and African American studies in arts and sciences at the University of Washington in St. Louis. And we're talking about the one-year anniversary of the killing of Michael Brown on the streets of Ferguson by a white police officer who, my understanding is that the white police officer is essentially sort of living in a home that was paid for by donations that he got. He's obviously seen as something of a hero amongst a lot of people in the United States, that they gave him money with which he was able to buy a house and live. I'm not sure how lavishly. Has anything happened on the Michael Brown family side? Have they been taken care of?
They are being taken care of. And I believe that there is still a civil suit pending. They received support from not only those of us in the St. Louis area, the metropolitan area, but across the nation. I believe the mother of Michael Brown, was flown out to New York just recently to commemorate certain events out there. So, yes, they are being taken care of, but we have to put that against the background of the loss of their son. He can never be replaced.
And in terms of the media, it seems that there has been a change in the way that the media now reports the killing of usually young black men by white police officers. Because, quite simply, in this age of social media and iPhones, what used to take place in the shadows, where a black man or a boy would be killed by a white policeman and it would simply not be a news story. And nowadays we've seen the video of the white policeman shooting the black motorist in the back who was
right,
running away from him. It was such an outrageous piece of film. It was almost as if this white policeman was just simply too lazy to chase after this motorist who was fleeing because he had a bunch of tickets, and yet he lost his life. And we've seen so many other incidents of that, and the latest of which, of course, has been the young woman in Texas who got pulled over for simply not indicating a lane change,
right.
And that led to her being manhandled, roughed up, and later dying in a local jail. So it seems to me that the availability of video evidence has forced the press not to buy the official line from the police departments routinely excusing themselves and denying any wrongdoing.
Absolutely. You know, I liken this to the introduction of the transistor radio and DVDs, private DVDs. I'm getting this analysis from Anthony Giddens in his book, The Runaway World. When you have access to things that you could privately control, there's a greater distribution in the case of the transistor radio, videotaping of culture around the world, and at the same time is being used nowadays to expose these errant practices. And so that is a great nod to these inventions. Once Gil Scott-Heron said, the revolution will not be televised, but now we can say, but it will be tweeted, it will be cellular phone-wise.
Right. It'll be on Facebook.
Right, and on Facebook.
Right. Well, in terms of the local government representation, because one of the issues that became so glaring following the death of Michael Brown was how little representation the majority black community had in their local government and particularly on their police force. How much has that changed?
Oh, I'm delighted to say that has changed greatly. At our last election, we increased the number of black representation greater than I believe it has ever been. And you can see the change is reflected in the tone of the government and how it is addressing the problems and challenges that we have in our community.
Well, that's sort of isn't that a test case of why voting matters?
Oh, absolutely. But at the same time, you have to have a majority or nearly a majority, because St. Louis County is a really interesting situation where the votes of all black folks will not necessarily result in the election of someone who will support their causes. And in fact, that is why politicians have been so indifferent to the black community, because they know they didn't receive their seats on their votes, by their votes, and that they could be reelected not communicating with black folks in the community. But now that has changed, and I believe people who of good faith of all backgrounds and of goodwill see what is happening and made a choice to make a difference.
Well, it would seem, though, that there's so much evidence, particularly since the Supreme Court struck Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and we just last week celebrated the 50th anniversary
right.
of the signing of the Voting Rights Act. As soon as they struck down that provision that pre-cleared states in the South with a history of racial discrimination, that immediately voter suppression bills were passed in the legislatures, particularly in Texas and North Carolina, and the battle continues. So it would seem to me that if these white racists, you know, this leftover from Jim Crow, basically doesn't want Americans from minority communities to vote, then, you know, that ought to be a powerful message that, you know, twofold. One is that if you don't have the representation, you get the kind of abuse that happened in Ferguson. And two, there are a lot of people out there that don't want you to vote. That ought to be a hell of a clue to saying, you know, you got to vote come hell or high water.
Well, that goes back to what I say about the tug of war. I cannot wrap my mind around the Supreme Court decision recently. And there have been efforts, local efforts, to enact those kind of laws. But fortunately, many of them didn't really make it past the paper. But that's exactly what I mean by a tug of war, a struggle, a going back and going forth.
So what's your sense of the new struggle then? We have often evoked Martin Luther King, but he was assassinated back in 1968, and that's a long time ago. So what's your sense as an African-American, Garrett, in terms of who do you look to for inspiration and leadership?
I'm glad you asked that question. Perfect question. I see two sources, and I can say it based upon what has resulted in the past. I see the young community, the youthful community, organizing in the same way it organized hip-hop to reduce violence in their community and to become a political force. I see the leadership of women coming back to fore, just as it did during the environmental racial movement that resulted in a movement that has been co-opted now. Movements and laws against environmental racism or environmental pollution in these communities began with Black women and Latino women, and they have been a benefit to everyone. And so, and I see this when I look on the radio or listen to the radio, look on the television, talk with individuals, especially my students. I see them organizing and coming together and drawing on their many resources. And I also see those in the business community, the legal fields, and even police officers providing substantive support for these movements led by youth and by women.
So on the downside, what needs to be fixed? You mentioned earlier there's been a number of deaths in Ferguson since the shooting of Michael Brown, and that has been black-on-black violence.
Right. And two things. One, we need to find the sources of the influx of the police, the guns, into these communities. Secondly, related to the police, police have to provide protection for these communities, and their absence in these communities in large part allow this violence to occur. And in fact, sometimes the police is even complicit. One account a few years ago here in the St. Louis area, an 8-year-old Black boy who was on his porch picking up bugs for a science project in school was actually murdered by some gang members who had retaliated against the family because they had pointed them out as distributing the drugs in the community. And they got their information from a police officer. This was reported on television by an alderman at the time. So this is not just on the ground swirl that or rumor that we're talking about. And this happens in several places. So to address this violence, we have to go twofold. We have to stop the influx of guns. And we're not talking about changing gun laws because these guns are in here illegally. And we also have to check the police and their practices, and out and even jail those errant officers.
And presumably, if this policeman snitched to the gang about who had tipped them off about the gang's selling of drugs, that is at the heart of it, isn't it? That these gangs, street gangs, are largely organized crime, drug distribution operations. So you get back to the war on drugs, don't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, you have to ask, what is the influx? How did these communities receive so many drugs in them? And it has to be stopped. And again, Black communities do not have control over that influx.
Well, Garrett Duncan, I thank you very much for joining us on the one-year anniversary of the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri.
Absolutely. I am delighted that you asked me, and I'm glad to participate in this conversation.
Well, we're very grateful. And again, I've been speaking with Garrett Duncan, who's a professor of education and of African and African-American studies in arts and sciences at the University of Washington in St. Louis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was